The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I think that you need to get your cable fixed and stop confusing me with your soap operas.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 17 for the week of January 20th, 2014. I am Sketchy Tenderloin David T. Cole, and I'm here with Presidio Preservation Committee Sarah D. Bunting.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Mission Burrito Eater Tara Ariano.
Extra cheese.
And Castro Pilgrim Mark Blankenship.
We'll have a gay old time.
Welcome back to Mark Blankenship, the fourth chair. He's here on this, he's able to record during the day because it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which we are observing, I don't know, not very thoughtfully, I guess. Well, let's say we're addressing a civil rights issue, sort of, by talking about HBO's new half-hour dramedy-looking, which has been billed as The Gay Girls, and which Mark will be covering for us on the site this season.
Indeed.
And so the premiere was last night as we record this. What did we think? Mark, you wrote about it. Why don't you lead us off?
Yeah, well, okay. As I said in the piece that I wrote, as I'm sure thousands of you have already read, I feel like that this is a show that doesn't suck. I mean, it's
okay,
no
moving
pun
on.
Intended. No, but it's like, it's not a terrible show. It's a show that I think has a lot of promise and certainly has a lot of very talented people working to create it. But at the same time, based solely on the pilot and, spoiler, the second episode, which I've already seen, I feel like that for me, it might have a short shelf life in the sense that it seems to only be about dating and sex, which are things that I like and am interested to hear about. Especially from gay characters who seem to exist outside of the typical mold of gay characters that we usually see on television. But I want to have sex and relationships be contextualized in the other things that make people people.
Yeah.
And I feel like I don't know how long I can go with one conversation.
Right. It did seem a little... I've only seen the pilot, and I liked it, but it was also a bit dull for me. There were some... there were some really good moments, like that blind date that they were on, or that whatever OkCupid date
right.
that they were on, which was horribly awkward, and the way that they did that was very deft throughout. I mean, the hallmark awkward moment is when they split the check. The guy's like, you know, let's just accept that this isn't working, and then splits the check at some length, and that was really cringy, but there were things throughout it that I thought were very subtle and well done. With that said, I also made a note that I was kind of more interested in Dom and his restaurant job and, like, when he's complaining about the Silicon Valley assholes and, like, what would he have to put up with on a daily basis at that job and what is that subculture like, that there are, like, these two subcultures that might be clashing in this restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I kind of would rather watch that show. Also, mm-hmm. I think Dom is the cutest one. That's
for sure.
Totally irrelevant to me. I like a porn stash. What can I say? Yeah, but I just, like, it got to the end and I was like, that was pleasant. I don't need to see anymore. And I'm not exactly sure why that is. I wasn't getting a Sex and Tales of the City vibe from it or anything, but I'm wondering if maybe now we're at the point in pop culture portrayals of, quote, the gay experience, unquote, that now that it's not seen so much as like this singular experience or that mm-hmm. there are types, that the fact is that like dating is a boring goddamn hassle for everyone. And maybe we don't actually need a show about how it affects certain subcultures or types of people.
Right.
Does anyone have any thoughts on why? I don't think it was boring because of the writing or the characters or anything like that. I just sort of felt like,
right.
I'm not sure why.
Well, there were no real dramatic stakes, really. That was, I think, just from speaking purely dramaturgically, these characters are not, these characters are not, nothing is at stake for them right now. And I don't need there to be like, oh God, there's a bomb that's going to blow up the bathhouse, because that was what Queer as Folk kept doing. And that was really frustrating.
I actually feel like I do kind of need that now.
But you know, if there was just...
That show would be called 24 Collective Inches. What?
Or Mark and Andrew's house. What? Oh,
boy.
Raising the table here at East Coast.
But I feel like it seems possible that maybe stakes will present themselves. Sarah's now thinking about what raising the table could mean. You could actually watch it happen on her face. Anyway, sorry.
Oh, that's exactly what I meant it to mean.
Okay, but it feels
like... I just cracked
myself up until I took a sip of...
But okay, so it's like... Right, I've only seen two episodes... It feels like even in the second episode, maybe they're easing into stakes a little bit more. So, Sarah, I can't... You, easing in? Okay.
You did that to yourself.
We're not... Well, there goes the Peabody. Oh. But I do hope that eventually the show finds a rhythm that allows it to have stakes for these characters and... That eventually that there is just, again, something more to talk about than the latest crappy date or the latest vague, whiny... I don't want to say whiny because they're not whiny, but there's just something ultimately stagnant about watching people pine for a better date week after week or whatever. I don't know if I'm being unfair, but that's how I feel.
I agree with everything you're saying. It did feel sort of aimless, but I kind of liked how understated it was, that it was sort of like, especially for a pilot, I liked that it was sort of observational. Like they didn't, you know, hit you over the head with exposition. Like the scene with Dom and his roommate, I thought was, that was maybe my favorite, perhaps because it was the only one with a woman in it, but, I forgot. Anne Magnuson was also in it, but they established these two have known each other since they were kids or teenagers. They were a couple at some point before Dom figured out that he was not into girls. And they had the funniest moment where he was saying, just blow off work and watch The View. And she was like, oh, I'd love to, but my patient who's 6 months old and has a heart disease.
Also.
Yeah, she's great. Lauren Weedman was really funny. But
and
I
just
I
that
thought,
they were being super inappropriate with each other the way old friends are,
I thought
it was very well written. And
I agree.
I hope to see more of that. And I think it's totally possible that once the show gets further into storylines, that this was more about establishing character and sort of setting everyone into their, you know, not areas. Areas.
They're areolas? What? But that's specifically why the piece that I wrote about the pilot, I filed it under Hope Watch.
Yeah.
Because there really is so much about the show, like you said, that it's very observational, for instance, that I think is really promising. And it is refreshing also, like I said, to see a show about gay characters that isn't necessarily about people having fearful moments of coming out, that isn't about people... who are dying because of the sex that they've had. And I like to think that even if they do eventually introduce a character with HIV into the show, that that character would be treated in a slightly different, less martyr-focused way than, say, any Oscar-nominated movie has ever treated a character with HIV.
I mean, it did come up in the terrible first date scene where the doctor just asks very matter-of-factly if Patrick was disease-free. So it's
Like,
it's already been an issue that's sort of like been brought up and dismissed. Not dismissed, but you know what I mean. Like it wasn't treated like a big momentous moment, you know?
Right. And in a way, I guess it's like the momentous thing about this pilot for me really was that we're watching characters who are already in the middle of being gay.
Yeah.
And like It's not the beginning of the journey. It's not the end of the journey. They're just gay guys who are living their lives, which is realistic in a way that is very rarely, I think, presented on television.
Yep.
Yeah. But then I think maybe that might have been the part of the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
Was like, right. They're just, you know, gay guys being gay guys, no big deal. But then it's like, okay, then what is your show about?
Right.
If it's not about other portrayals that we've seen, if you're sort of trying to prove a negative in terms of it's not queer as folk.
Or Mitch and Cam, right. Or whatever.
The luxury that people who get HBO deals have, though, is that they get the full season.
Yes.
So, you know, right. It could be that the writers are taking their time and they're setting up the show, you know, without having to have a contrivance, you know, to sort of be the catalyst for whatever right away. And, you know, it just might be that they're, you know, easing into something. And whereas if it was on network, then that might mm-hmm. be different.
It also, I think, doesn't bother me so much when a TV show doesn't make a, when a show like this doesn't make a big deal about actually having a story. I know this is giving them way too much credit, but like,
this gay guy has to be the other gay guy butler. What would happen then?
But, you know, like, I have much more patience with a TV show just sort of being like, this is a character study and we're just checking in with these characters every week and sometimes stuff happens and sometimes it doesn't, versus, like, I feel like last year was a big year for movies where they didn't actually have much of a story, where it was just sort of like, we're hanging out with these characters for a while for no reason. Like, I mean, I guess This Is 40 was technically 2012, but like Admission was sort of like that, where it's just like someone wrote some characters they liked and then they just wanted to have not very much bad stuff happen to them. Mm-hmm. For me, that works better in a TV show where you have the chance to like watch a character's lives for over a longer period of time than in a movie where it's sort of like, well, why am I watching this then? Like, get somewhere. Right.
And that, but that said, if it's the same thing every week where it's just dates, then you're going to lose interest. But, you know, I think it's safe to assume that will not be the case. But, you know,
and in terms of this being, as it's sort of been reduced to, the gay girls, I'm much more interested in these characters than I am in the ones on Girls.
Yes, who
I
find absolutely.
Very it really tiresome. Helps that they're not. You know, yeah, they're hateful, but that's the point. Like, you know, there's only so many hours in the TV watching day, and I kind of don't need to do that.
And also, the youngest central character on Looking is 30. And I think that's a big difference. I mean, I think it is more, to me, just personally being in older than my 20s, I just am interested in watching shows about people who
Mark is 53, you guys.
Now that, I mean, as someone who voted for Coolidge, I am really interested in, but I think it's great to watch characters who are a little older, who have more things figured out.
Yeah.
And I think too, I don't want to overplay my negative responses to the pilot, because it's only 8 episodes, and I feel like ultimately it could end up feeling like one long story. And I have to trust the
That's true.
Because Weekend, the movie that the guy, I can't pronounce his last name, Andrew Haig, whatever. The guy who's direct.
Haig.
Exactly. Weekend was a really slow burn, but by the end of that film, it really felt like a lot had happened and that we had snowballed into a lot of emotional event. And so I feel like maybe over 8 20-minute episodes, we're going to get one long story that feels like it really is saying something.
Yeah, that's true. That that is a good example of like when you got to that payoff, it really had been earned.
Right.
Carefully. That it did seem a little slow until you got to the end.
Right.
You realized what had been happening. So maybe that's the...
And also, I just have to say, venally, perhaps, that I'm not going to be mad about a show that's maybe a little bit boring, but also includes really cute men taking off their clothes.
Seriously.
True.
I can't apologize. I won't apologize.
I will say, since you brought him up, I do think Jonathan Groff is the weakest of the cast, and I hope over the course of the show, he gets a little bit less stagey than he felt to me in the pilot.
Hmm.
Just me.
Mm-hmm.
Which one is he?
He's the Patrick.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like
Mr. X Zachary Quinto.
Yeah.
Really?
X? Did they break up? I think they did.
I think they did. Maybe. Remember. I don't know. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Somebody knows. I don't. But
they do.
I feel like that he is being given the role of our surrogate, too, and that he's the one who's naive and has to learn everything.
Of course.
Yeah.
Which is an uncomfortable place for someone who's been friends with these people for so long. It's a tricky character to write, I guess. But I can't disagree. But again, hopefully all of that will mature with time.
And moving on.
Yes, by looking, we'll be looking out for you next week.
I thought we were going to get the going from one topic to another. An appropriate segue. Makes it smooth as butter. Dave's shaking his head at me. He's so disgusted.
Okay.
Let's give you a chance. Anyway, speaking of HBO on Sunday nights.
God damn it, Dave.
You son of a bitch.
Fuck off, Cole.
Anyway, speaking of HBO Sunday nights, True Detective, which Sarah has been writing about for us. Sarah, why don't you bring us into it?
True Detective is sort of an anthology show on HBO Sunday nights. It stars Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson as two detectives in Louisiana, working for, I think, Louisiana's like state FBI,
yeah.
basically,
yep.
and trying to figure out what's going on with this ritual killing where this probably former prostitute was like tied to
or
a tree.
Or Prost.
Prost. Yes. You know, they all have their own lingo for that. But she had antlers on. It was this very sort of like Hannibal-style mm-hmm. staging. Was it related to a girl's disappearance from, you know, even before that? And on top of that, this all happened in 1995. And we are seeing flashbacks to them as partners who don't necessarily like each other that much, trying to solve this crime. And then in 2012, being interviewed by current detectives because another similar ritual killing has happened. And I think at this point in the show, we're meant to understand that Cole with an H, played by Matthew McConaughey, that the current detectives think he has something to do with it because mm-hmm. he's this very like, you know, Khalil Gibran quoting insomniac, alcoholic weirdo who tends to have chemical flashbacks of some kind while riding around in the car with Woody Harrelson, who was much more of a like good old boy standard detective cheating on his wife with a court reporter and then making excuses to her about how he doesn't want to bring the job home. So these are very mismatched partners. They're trying to figure this case out in 95 and in 2012. And like, it's, first of all, it sounds more complicated than it is. I'm not doing a great job explaining it. The show does a very good job moving back and forth between the timelines, and the acting is amazing. Harrelson and McConaughey mm-hmm. are really great. Harrelson has, okay, you can tell it's a wig, but it's one of the better wigs it's that you see in prime time.
The wig work on this show, I feel like the wig cop is not writing a citation for this show. For
no,
me.
They're decent. Yeah. They're decent wigs.
For what it is, for, you know, man wigs.
Sure.
They're pretty good.
It's like they really looked at what his hair looked like on Cheers and went for that.
Yeah.
And just, Harrelson is... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, quick point of clarification. You said it's an anthology series, which it is, but each season is going to be one story. So it's like...
Correct.
It's not like... this will be with Woody and Matt for the
Right,
for
it's
the
not the Twilight Zone. So for yeah. this season, we will be with this story.
Yeah, American Horror Story style.
Right.
Right.
I think it's 8 episodes as well.
That sounds right.
But Harrelson is like kind of this Jimmy McNulty from The Wire, but of the Bayou. that he's like, he's charming and he's trying to be a good cop, but he's also like pretty fucked up in the way that cops can be. Drinks too much, not faithful to his wife. And then Rust Cole is this like kind of post-hippie pessimist philosopher who should be really annoying, especially in the present day interrogation where he's like smoking in the room, sends them out to get him a six pack of Lone Star Tall Boys.
And they do.
And they do. He's like, well, you can do it or I can stop talking. And they're like, okay, and try it out to the 7-Eleven, I guess. But he has these like long monologues about abstractions and what happened after his daughter's death, and it really should not work, but it does.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Because the acting is amazing, and also the plotting is pretty solid in terms of just kind of moving things along, like showing them running down witnesses and getting addresses, and, you know, now a task force has been appointed, and their captain is trying to buy them some time with that, and, you know, I think the way that it moves the timeline along is good and not too flashy, and even the like chemical flashbacks I could do with a little less of that kind of thing, but for some reason they really sell it. And another thing going for it, in my opinion, is that Cary Fukunaga, who directed that Jane Eyre adaptation from a year or two ago, is directing the entire season. So there's director continuity, and I like that he can look at texts and drop out stuff that's not important. Like, he has a way of leeching some saccharin out of things that shouldn't work on the page. So far, I'm really enjoying it and looking forward to where they go with it. But it's interesting that as far as the serial killer plot, it's not necessarily anything you haven't seen done 100 times. But because of these characters being kind of two sides of the same coin, clashing with each other, we find out that somewhere in the interim they stopped speaking, and Cole went off the grid for a while. I think the character work is really interesting, and they have just the right balance of atmosphere and also story, like the narrative.
The other thing they weave in really well is actually just the police work.
Right.
And it's interesting without being flashy, you know, like it doesn't have to be kind of, you know, the Law and Order big reveals while on the beat, you know, happen to be the right place at the right time kind of stuff. It's just sort of they have working the case, and it's really interesting, and it's everything is so understated. Yet, as you say, like on the face of it, it seems like it shouldn't work. But it really does, and the police work is part of that puzzle.
Well, the other thing that was interesting in the second episode is that we find out that part of the reason that Marty has been so successful in his career, at least according to his whatever captain or boss, the Kevin Dunn character, is he's sort of like, every case you've broken has been super duper easy. Like every you just managed to stumble on it in like two days. You know, you just that despite what TV and movies would have you think, most criminals are not geniuses. Right. And most of the time they just fuck up. And so that's why Marty has had such a high clearance rate, perhaps.
I also loved that scene because it gave you a glimpse into sort of like The First 48, which is a nonfiction show. That goes to what you were just saying, that most criminals, like once you bring in the guilty party and you're like, what happened? They just tell you.
Yeah.
Like, they know they're busted. And until the lawyer shows up, they're like, okay, well, you know, he said some shit about my mom, so I shot him.
Right.
And that's how most of these murders get solved. Right. Criminals aren't that bright. They don't plan.
Yeah.
And that he was giving us some information, like, how many of these have you solved that, like, after a week went by? None. Like, then it starts to be a cold case type situation. I thought that was interesting in terms of the way that the police think of the odds and how they do their jobs. And also that he implied in that scene that a lot of Marty's success has been because he knows how to shut the fuck up.
Right.
And not, you know, not be all Joe College about theories of the crime and buying Quaaludes from Prosts.
Well, the other thing that comes through, sorry, Mark, just one more thing, is how much it's clear from everybody, no one would give a shit about this case except for the ritual aspects of it. Like, she was a prostitute. She ran away. It wouldn't be a big deal to work on this case at all, except that she was found with, like, markings on her back and antlers, you know.
And especially in this part of the country, the implication that there's some satanic thing happening means it's immediately a headline.
Right.
It needs a task force, et cetera, and so on.
Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, gosh. No, that was a really good point. It actually made me think of something else. So I thank you and doff my cap to you. So the thing that what you were just talking about made me think about, one of the things I love about this show so far is that they will put the thread of the religious fervor of the community in there just brightly enough to give it some sort of sense of tension, but they don't overdo it. I feel like they've introduced a lot of different types of tensions within this world that all feel very alive, but they don't linger on them so heavily, or they don't explicate them so heavily that you feel you've been bludgeoned by the symbolism.
Right.
And I feel like the whole thing about there's like a class thing that's happening in there, and like, I loved the scene in the Bunny Ranch where the prostitute said to Woody Harrelson's character, the reason men like you don't like it when women like us sell our bodies is because that means you don't own it like you thought you did. And I felt like that whole scene was, first of all, very well acted, but there was also a lot of class and gender stuff that was just sort of presented. Yeah. And I really liked it.
I didn't care for that.
Oh.
Yeah. No, well. I thought that was a little like, I didn't think that character would say that. I think it's true, but I think there was another way to make the point that was a little truer to what her voice was.
A little more true detective, if you will.
I mean, and they give Cole lines like that all the time, and somehow it works for him. But from her, I wasn't buying it. I think it was a good point. It just was made clumsily, in my opinion.
And then him giving that younger girl the money on the way out the door and thinking it made him completely moral when it had just been contrasted with him using essentially that other woman and getting mad at her for not letting him own her, his like girlfriend on the side. Mm-hmm. All very complicated and meaty. But the other thing about the show that I love, it is avoiding a very common pitfall for writers, which is very often when writers use a flashback or memory play structure, they forget to instill the present moment with any sense of stakes, to come back to that idea again. Mm-hmm. So often you feel like what you're watching is something dead in a way because you already know by watching what's happening in the present who survived or whatever.
Right, sure.
And one of the things that they've done here is they've invested the present moment with this new sense of mystery. So as an audience member, I get to enjoy both the mystery of this case that unfolds in 1995, but I also get to enjoy the other mystery of trying to figure out why they've called them in now. And it's not just that there's been a new murder, although that's interesting too. There's something about the power dynamics that have shifted, and there's all this stuff that's happening in 2012 that feels very present and active and important. And I think that by creating two simultaneous mysteries for me to unravel as a viewer makes me feel incredibly invested in the show and honestly makes me forgive a lot of what Sarah pointed out, which is the tendency to rehash tropes that we've seen in 100 other shows like this.
Right. No, I agree. And contrast that with The Following, which came back last night and is much improved, even though that's saying almost nothing. But I also covered The Following for previously, and that's an example of using flashbacks just to kind of not fill time, but to like misunderstanding what information an audience needs mm-hmm. to be interested. And that's a perfect example. I would never have looked at the flashback and said, that's why it doesn't work. But your explanation of it as sort of, why do we care about this in the present? We already have the information we need from this.
Mm-hmm.
Flashback is exactly it. That it's like, this isn't adding anything. This isn't raising the stakes. This isn't explaining the stakes. This is just a chance for Kevin Bacon to act intoxicated, which he's not great at, P.S. Right.
And like, if you're Tennessee Williams and you've written The Glass Menagerie and you have this mastery of poetic language.
Which I am.
Then, yeah. Well, so you and Tennessee. So Tara and Tennessee. It's one, then your flashback or memory frame can be static because the language itself is so beautiful. But most of the time, a la The Following, people cannot get it together.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I agree that especially that Matthew McConaughey is doing something really special. It shouldn't work. I dread to think what would be happening if a lesser actor were playing that part because,
right.
As Sarah said, it should be so annoying. But the other thing that's fascinating to me is the contrast between him in the initial case and him in the present. Because something has happened to this guy.
How did he good old boyify?
That's the thing. Like, how did he change from being this sort of ethereal, philosophy-quoting, you know, weirdo, as Sarah said, perfect word, to being this sort of, like, deadened, defeated, pragmatist alcoholic, you know? Granted, he was probably always an alcoholic, but you know what I mean? Like, in the present, he's just like, well, I give up, you know? So what happened to get him there?
And that hair is jacked in the present.
Yeah.
It's not great.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, good show. My one criticism after the pilot was I wished there had been a few more moments of levity because otherwise it's very...
All the levity you need is the big hug mug in the interrogation scene.
That
should bring you through the whole thing.
It's quite a character. I'm not going to deny that. But I thought the second episode, that scene with Kevin Dunn, reading them... giving them shit was
watch the pilot And then immediately went online to find myself a big Hug-A-Mug, which I did.
We're looking at it right now. Dave is ashing into it as we speak.
Well, I was just going to say.
You're pouring Pabst into it as we speak.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
I am not a crackpot, but I feel that after the weekend airing by Lifetime of the Flowers in the Attic remake, ably covered by my esteemed colleague Tara previously, please read it. It's brilliant. And I believe they're doing the sequel, Petals on the Wind or In the Wind or In Your Face.
Recasting Kathy, I would imagine, because she's quite a bit older. Kiernan Shipka maybe could play 15, but much older than that is going
to
be
well, and
tough.
That I think you pointed to that as a kind of major problem with the casting of this one, which you can elaborate on in a moment if you wish. But here is my non-crackpotty proposal, and it is this. V.C. Andrews also wrote a standalone called My Sweet Audrina, which featured, among other things, a sex scene on an open grave and the main character who was her own parents time shifted her so that she would forget that she had been raped. So instead of being 15, she was like 7, and they just would change the clocks around and drug her. And
what?
Then they told
it's
her that she was her
bonkers.
Own sister.
Yeah.
It's crazy. We did it on Tomato Nation Book Club one time, and people who hadn't read it in 10 years were like, this is even more effed than I recall. Like, it was terrible. That like someone with a club foot pushes her down the stairs. It's so badly written that you almost still can't even get through it despite the scandalous material. But one of Tara's points was in her piece on Flowers in the Attic was, is it possible that this stuff just isn't adaptable?
It was,
the
point I was trying to make was like, it's hard to, you can't replicate the feeling of being a kid reading that book because you're like, I can't believe what's happening. And so when you actually watch it as an adult, it's like, you know. Like, my sister and I read a child called It after we saw the author on Oprah, which is also debatably, probably, maybe a work of fiction about this kid and the horrible abuse that he suffered, which is really over the top. However, my point was, like, since the time that I read the book and since the time that most of the target audience for the movie probably read the book, we really have become accustomed to seeing horrible shit on TV all the time. So it's hard to replicate the experience of the book. In addition to which, there's really not that much plot in the book. It's more of a character study. And so there, without that many events to sort of bring the movie along, it was a little bit boring. But My Sweet Audrina is different.
And there are things that you just like, yes, you can imply things like SVU, for example, being what it is, but they don't actually really show children, like little ones, being bad touched.
Yeah.
Or like little kids or sort of young adolescents making out with each other.
Yeah.
Which you would like to really get the shock value of Flowers in the Attic, etc., you would really have to do that. And My Sweet Audrina, like, how is that going to work? Like, how are you going to cast that? Do you just get, like, three different girls? And also sex on an open grave. I mean, that's the conceptual one, but still.
Yeah. When you say on an open grave, you mean, like, they're in the hole? Like, they're down there, they climbed into the hole of the grave?
I believe they're in a pile of dirt next to the grave that she has opened to try to find her sister's corpse and has realized that she is her own sister and they've been fucking with her head for, like, 10 years. And
of course, then that makes her horny.
Yeah.
Obviously.
And then the whole reason they sort of have been keeping her away from her like boyfriend is that he was present at the gang rape and did nothing to stop it and may have participated. So they have this, like, of course it starts raining and then they have this frankly I think not geometrically possible sexual intercourse on a pile of dirt.
Okay,
this is making me really want to reread the book. I have to say,
I am not a crackpot part two. I feel like one successful way that you could do this would be to stage it as like a kind of Greek tragedy, like really ratchet it up, like take it to a really Greek place, because what you just described basically is the plot. It's like Greek. Basically what Clytemnestra
what
did,
saying.
You know, like really ratchet it up so that we've got that Clytemnestra level of like gods and chaos and cosmic power. I'm just saying.
Mm-hmm. You could throw in a poisoned garment.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Anyway, if you're going to go for it, Lifetime, really go for it. My Sweet Audrina, 2015, make it happen. I am not a crackpot.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
See to my pants, I am not a crackpot. But I am not a crackpot. But in order for the Flowers in the Attic Andrews series to really have the effect that it was meant to, it should be aired by Nickelodeon.
With Linda Ellerbe hosting a special right before.
Jesus Christ, fuck off, Cole.
Cole, we got a new rule around here, especially for you. You got an opinion about anything? You hold on to it.
Gentlemen, to Weevil.
Hi, Extra Hot Great. My name is Nick, and I'm submitting to the canon Season 1, Episode 9 of The Amazing Race, The Unexpected Twist. From the episode title, you might think that this is an instance of a producer-inserted complication, but in this early installment of The Amazing Race, there's refreshingly little of that. Instead, the teams are really forced to live and die by their own ability to, one, get stuff done quickly, and two, not psych themselves out, and this episode really bears that out. The centerpiece for the episode is the fight for the fast forward between the snazzy villains of Team Guido and lovable underdogs Nancy and Emily, as well as a diabolical detour which forces teams to choose between a slow bus trip or searching the streets of Bangkok for a specific private car. The way the various teams respond to this makes it a crucial turning point in the race, in that it sets the tone for how they'll do right up to the last episode. Frank and Margarita and the lawyers efficiently tackle opposite sides of the detour and set themselves up as frontrunners, while Nancy and Emily and the Guidos both crash and burn in ways they won't be able to recover from. As a bonus for the Guidos, this will eventually lead to the hilarious cut in the finale, away from the winner celebrating in New York to Team Guido shivering in Alaska all by themselves. It's the heartbreaking battle between the dastardly Guidos and Team Momley that makes this episode a real standout. Bill and Joe snag the fast forward in a tense, tightly edited sequence, so it seems like Nancy and Emily are done for. But when the Guidos suffer a rare mental lapse that would put them hours behind, it looks like the mother-daughter team has a window of opportunity. The only problem is that Nancy and Emily don't reckon with the possibility of the Guido slipping up. They're worn down by Team Guido's seeming invincibility, and after spending a few hours wandering the streets of Thailand, they're despondent and sure that they're out of the running, and decide to bail on the detour entirely, a choice that will ultimately lead to a 24-hour penalty and their elimination.
Let's just hire a cab. Will they disqualify? I don't care. I do not care. That's a great attitude, Mom. Well, honey, we could walk the towel.
Yeah, they will walk for 5 hours.
Okay. It's throwing in the towel, honey.
No, I don't want it to go out like that.
You know what? This just said, Emily, it says within the boundaries.
Can I buy bus number 81?
No, we have to take a cab.
We're right here. We have to go right here.
Yes, Mom, he knows it.
You know how to get there?
Can you take us there?
You know, we've already walked for 2 hours, Emily, and didn't even cover it all.
Nancy and Emily have chosen to not complete the detour, which requires them to go to Kanchanaburi by either public bus or one of the private cars hidden in the neighborhood. Instead, they have chosen to hire a cab.
It plays out like a Greek tragedy, with the underdogs coming this close to taking out the smug villains, and it's easy to find yourself rooting for Momley, even knowing the outcome 12 years after the fact.
Joe and Bill, you were the 15th to arrive.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Wow.
And I remember saying, oh, my God, Bill, we're being eliminated. It was one of the worst experiences that I've ever had in my life.
Problem is, Nancy and Emily, you chose to not do the detour. That was a conscious decision on your part, and according to the rule book, that results in a 24-hour penalty.
And with the time penalty, you guys are still in the race.
I'm so sorry for that.
And Nancy and Emily have been eliminated.
I'm sorry.
When we deliberately broke that rule,
it was not to cheat to get ahead of the other team.
No,
it was simply to get out of that situation and get it over with.
You guys played really good tonight.
Really?
Thank you. Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I agreed to throw in the towel prematurely. Emily did not want to, and I will always feel bad about encouraging her to do that.
The Amazing Race is still working out some kinks in this first season. Host Phil Keoghan is sidelined and restricted to voiceovers until the last few moments, for one thing. But there's something exciting about the way the show just sends the teams out in the world and trusts the results to be compelling, without much manipulation. The episode also features Phil's brilliant pronunciation of the word Buddha,
Buddha.
Terrific scenery, and plenty of small moments of the teams enjoying the race, like Rob being adorably woken up by a puppy, and Drew's language barrier misunderstanding at a train station in India.
I don't understand. Did someone speak English back then? Does anybody speak English? Can you please ask him, what time does the train for Delhi leave?
What time of the train?
The episode is a great example of The Amazing Race doing what it does best, as well as a turning point for how the teams will finish the race, and compulsively rewatchable, by no means the norm when it comes to reality TV. I think that it deserves a spot in the canon, and I hope you'll agree.
Thank you.
Nick.
Thank you, Nick. Just one.
Very nice job.
Yes, one more clip that I wanted to cut, because it was so shocking when we started to watch this, how unbelievably, I mean, he sort of alludes to this as being the first season and some kinks still being worked out, but Phil's narration in the opening recap is so low energy, it is actually hilarious.
Yeah.
I made a huge note about it, yeah.
Here it is.
Will it be last place teams Nancy and Emily, or Team Guido? Or will one of the leading teams make a fatal error? Who will be eliminated tonight?
Tonight.
Yeah, tonight. I mean, it's really like he
and
recorded
And they said
this.
Tonight, that was the thing that I thought you were going to point out.
Oh, yeah, right.
It's always, who will be eliminated next?
Next, right. But still, that he was like, okay, I'm just going to do this like one quick run through, and then this will just be temp file. And then I'll do it for real. But then they accidentally used his rehearsal. This is such a good episode. I had forgotten that Team Guido even was season one. Like once we saw all the cast in the opening, I knew this was still from when we watched the show. But the idea of a team like branding themselves that way seemed to me like something that would have happened later on. But no, this is season one, and. God, it really felt so packed with stuff. Like, there was so little filler in this episode. If every episode was still this eventful, I probably still would be watching The Amazing Race, which I haven't watched in many seasons. But, like, he's right that the fast-forward face-off is really well-edited. Now, I think when people get to a fast-forward and see someone else is there, they're just like, well, fuck it. Let's just go and do whatever else instead, that they don't even bother. And this was also before bunching was much of a thing, which is, I think, why Bill and Joe ended up getting left so far behind in the finale, as he references. That never happens now, I feel like.
Well, because this was filmed in, whatever, summer of 2001.
Right.
And once September of 2001 happened, there was a lot of bunching that just was in order for them to be able to travel practically.
Right.
That couldn't be avoided. But yeah, that was interesting to me too. That and the credits, there was not one creepy head turn.
No, it's true. That's true.
I looked, watched them twice. Everyone was just normal. So it's like, hey, here's the camera. Like, thank you.
Yeah. But they, I mean, the face-off that it ended up coming down to Nancy and Emily versus Bill and Joe, and Nancy and Emily, so sweet, when they lose at the fast-forward, Nancy, like, pastes on that smile, is like, let's go congratulate them, such a mom moment.
Yeah.
And then it's, like, the nice girls versus the evil guys, and then they totally, even if they had spent 5 hours looking for that car, they still would have beat them. It's, like, it really is tragic in a dramaturgical sense, Mark. I know things too. So amazing episode and so suspenseful and fun, and really, as we hope for the canon, an example of the best that a given show can be.
Before we go any further, I just want to pitch something to Sarah and Tara, which is this. I think when we have a guest and a user canon, we should let the guest vote on the canon.
Okay.
Oh.
All right, Mark.
I just assumed that would be happening.
All right. Oh. Well, we never did that in the last time, but I think it's time for the guest to step up and be part of the amazing process that is the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Guest. What would Tennessee Williams have made of this?
Well,
the structuring.
I feel like
of this
I can speak for him. When
memory
I say.
Play.
I really think that we're in more of a Thornton Wilder territory here. But there's also something about the anthropomorphizing of the soul, I think, as well. No. You know what is interesting for me?
What? Get out.
I don't know.
Fuck off, Cole.
Listen, 87 to 88% of being in a dramaturgy master's degree program is using words confidently, even if they don't have any real value in a conversation.
That's
much
most
like
master's
creative
programs.
Writing program.
Uh-huh. So here was my truth. I did not start watching The Amazing Race until season 12.
Wow.
So okay. For me, this was like a trip into a really bizarre, through the looking glass version of the show. Mm-hmm. And it was, I cannot express to you how strange it was, because I have never, I didn't start watching until like 2008. So they had, whatever they hadn't worked out before, they had worked out here. Like when I started watching, Andrew, my husband, told me, oh yeah, there used to be times when someone would get so far ahead on the airplane that it wouldn't matter, like no one could ever catch up to them. Well, that was already not happening by the time that I started watching the show.
Yeah.
So for me, honestly, I didn't like this episode.
Oh.
I was bored. I was really bored. And I was like, why is it taking so long? Why is the pacing so weird? Why is there no, like, why isn't Phil, like, pushing the action forward with his... So to me, it was like, oh, gross. I just think it's really interesting that I didn't... And, you know, another thing that's true is because I didn't know anything about the first season, I was like, oh, those gay guys are so nice to everyone. Then I come to find out that they're the villains, and I was like, oh, really? Yeah. So in this one episode, they did not seem
were
that villainous
so
to me.
I know. Yeah, little really did we know bad. How bad things would get. Fucking well, Flo and Zach.
I also forgot that I really did not like Nancy and Emily as a team or individual.
Well, did you know that Nancy has died?
Of, no.
She had Lou Gehrig's disease, and she died a few years ago. I found that out on Wikipedia.
You're going to feel really bad
I
when
no
you
response
vote against
to
this
that.
Episode, Mark.
So,
jeez.
Guess she doesn't feel bad about making that decision anymore. Oh, too soon.
So I don't know. It was fascinating for me to... It's kind of like when I experience opera, and there are people around me who really get the language of what they're experiencing.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Do I sound like... I'm sorry. God, I didn't mean to sound... The point of... Leave me alone. I made a lot of jokes about erections and sex, like, at
you
the
did.
Very beginning of this.
You sure did.
Wait,
basically,
minute. I got something to help.
Amazing. Well, okay, so let's put it this way. It's kind of like when there are people around me who are watching football, and they get really into it and excited.
Yes.
And I don't get the language. I don't speak. So I feel like I don't speak the language of first season Amazing Race. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's too late for me to be invested in it, because the language that I started speaking about this show is so wildly different.
Yeah.
I can't go back.
No, I get that.
What do you think, Sarah?
I didn't have that problem. This was a great trip down memory lane for me. Mm-hmm. For those of you who don't know, I drive a smart car. This season of The Amazing Race is why I waited literally 8 years for them to come to the United States and bought one. And now I drive it around. I don't look quite as awesome as Drew and Kevin looked in it, but I'd forgotten like how hilarious that and charming they were.
Yeah.
He's like, I was like Baryshnikov in there, like with the tiger pit.
Yeah. Oh, you don't make fun of him for talking about Baryshnikov, but I mentioned opera. Okay.
Maybe if you talked about Baryshnikov, Mr. Masters.
Let's all stop cyberbullying Mark. Sarah, continue.
Oh, I'm bullying him in person. Back off. Let me work. I thought it was great to revisit this season and these teams, and also that one sort of like halcyon season they had before super crazy terrorist related travel restrictions really affected what the show was able to do. In some ways, I have to give the show credit for really rising to that challenge, but that I'm so glad that Nick mentioned what I call the best reality TV edit ever, which was that smash cut to the Guidos. Like, and there was a howling wind and like this helicopter shot of mountain peaks, and they're like shivering in their hoods and everything. Yeah. And I was watching that in a bar, and like the whole place just went nuts. It was like the best cut I ever saw.
You're talking
saw.
About the finale.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm glad he mentioned it, even though we didn't see it in this episode. But I think The Amazing Race was never quite able to get back to this, like, sort of innocent, pure state of itself. I still watch it on and off, but this was a great episode. Classic teams, no real villains. Like, the Guidos are so lightweight as far as evil went. I can't believe we ever got head up about them and their little purse dog. But, yeah, I think this is a great submission and a great... It's a savvy choice in terms of trying to get a reality show into the canon. So I will vote yes for this.
Yeah, it's interesting, first seasons of all reality shows before people can start figuring out how to game it and how to sort of get the fastest from A to B, literally in this case, I suppose. But, you know, like American Idol, how people started gaming the the silly bit before and just, you know, I'm the worst singer in the world. Here I go, you know. So, yeah, season one of The Amazing Race is really interesting in that way. And I totally get what you're saying, Mark, that it's sort of watching a proto version of a show that you've come to enjoy for, you know, being what it is. And now you're sort of, you know, you've gone from spelling things out to like having to use cuneiform or something like that. And you just kind of don't quite get
cuneiform.
It.
Cuneiform. Fuck off, Cole.
As I've mentioned many times in the show, I'm not a big reality show guy. I did watch Amazing Race when it was on. I thought of those reality shows, it was probably one of the best ones out there. I always take exception when people say it is the most realistic because it is as realistic as something that is not realistic. it's the tiger scene was so edited. You know, when you first see what is supposed to be kind of a first person view of somebody walking through, it's super duper fake. And once you start looking out for those kind of things, you can never stop. And which is my problem with reality shows. I just can't like turn my mind off and just go, you know, oh, I'm just going to enjoy this. I have to be the cameraman. I have to be the you know, the director or the producer. So it was interesting to watch this to see the start of all those things that would become more and more obvious as the seasons went on, especially that one with the, I think it was the first All-Stars with the Boston Rob amazing plane turnaround and that kind of stuff, where it just gets more and more obvious. I thought this was interesting as a trip down memory lane. It is a really good choice within this season to pitch for the canon. I think like, the last, as we're saying, the finale has that big moment with the Alaskan camera cutaway. And, you know, we're thinking about other shows that might be able to get in. I can only think of moments. Like, I really remember loving the Mitchell moment in Survivor, where they kind of screwed him over en route to tribal council. And he was just taken aback. He had no idea it was coming. Like, that's a great moment. But the episode itself, meh. This episode has a lot going for it. There's a lot of interesting things happening. And as Tara says, it's jam-packed of stuff. In a way that I think they started... future seasons had more padding. That said, I'm torn whether this canon submission is going to be the best of a really good example of The Amazing Race doing what it did best, or whether it's sort of, does this, should this earn a spot with the rest of the canon submissions? And that's my choice. So let's make this dramatic, shall we?
Oh,
and put this to a vote.
Sarah has already voted yes.
Tara?
I have.
I vote yes as well.
And Mark?
I vote no.
I am also going to vote no. although this is a good episode of The Amazing Race, I think
don't
that...
Don't Dave points let you break one of these ties? I feel like I remember that. From reading Euripides. See what I did there?
I just think that maybe you know, this is a really good show, episode of The Amazing Race, but I don't really think it holds up as exceptional television as much as it is, for me, a trip down memory lane to a more innocent time of the reality show, you know, era. So I am also going to vote no, which makes it a split decision, which means that, unfortunately, split decisions... Amazing Race, Season 1, Episode 9, The Unexpected Twist by Split Decision. It was a squeaker, but you are not inducted into the extra hot great canon. Thank you very much, Nick, for the submission. That was great, and you earned yourself an extra credit. Redeemable for an extra hot great topic of your choosing. Email me, and we'll hook you up. Now it's time for Around the Dial.
The CW just acquired a four-part miniseries called Labyrinth, but before you get excited, it is not a remake of Jim Henson's Labyrinth. It has to do with something else. Who cares? Lady Sybil from Downton Abbey is in it. That's all of the only other thing I was going to say, Sarah.
Speaking of who cares, the Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, Law & Order SVU Fire PD crossover event is coming that absolutely no one asked for.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
CBS's Intelligence lost 54% of its premiere audience when it moved to its permanent time slot, and the world makes sense to me again.
The RuPaul's Drag Race answer to Phil Robertson is a Tuck Dynasty promo poster. And indirectly, Duck Dynasty's own 3 million viewer nosedive after the premiere.
Yep. Sucka. Bill Paxton is coming to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., presumably because he heard our designated S.H.I.E.L.D. watcher, Nick Reinwald Jones, talking about Big Love on the last podcast.
Oh, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Oh, boy.
Do you still miss Alex Trebek's sweet stash?
Yes.
Crackle.com is airing vintage Jeopardies from the 80s and beyond.
Oh, that'd be good.
Oh.
Questions were harder back then.
Lots of questions about the Soviet Union that no one's going to get now.
Yeah. And Atari.
Charlie Kaufman is making a sitcom for FX that will star John Hawkes and Michael Cera. Nothing wrong with this at all, as far as I'm concerned.
And speaking of FX, they're getting into the authenticated subscriber streaming game a la HBO Go. Finally.
Mm-hmm. And Jezebel offered $10,000 for unretouched photos from Lena Dunham's Vogue shoot and got them the next day. What did they prove? Really nothing. Hope it was worth it. I guess they probably got $10,000 worth of traffic out of it.
Probably, yep.
Americans love a winner.
Yeah.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. And Tara, who's our very special winner this week?
Our winner is Mark Blankenship.
Yay!
And why is that?
Last summer, Mark Blankenship wrote a program parole board about Batman, making his very strong, very impassioned case for why the show should be released on DVD. And last week, it was announced Batman will be released.
You did it, Mark.
You did it, Mark.
Oh, my God.
It's 100% because of you.
It honestly, my entire life, it narrows down to this point, honestly.
Congratulations.
I get to see the King Tut episodes. Yay!
And a loser of the week, Sarah?
I have our loser. It's a bachelor, Juan Pablo, outing himself, as it were, as a homophobe and also thinking pervert is an adjective. He basically was like, gay people should get married and it sets a bad example for kids.
Subsequently, he tried to claim that it was a language issue, but I don't think anyone really believes that was the explanation.
No.
No, it was like three paragraphs worth of language issue. It wasn't like a...
Yeah.
It wasn't like one or two words taken out of context. He went on for a while.
Lesson,
don't go to the open bar at TCA.
I believe he went... Didn't he, like, go to college in America or something? Like, I feel like some of his language problems are maybe trumped up for the cameras, a la Sofia Vergara.
Mm.
See,
I wonder if they're going to cancel his cameo on the season finale of Looking.
Mm. I have a question for you all.
Oh,
yes.
Do you know what time it is?
Batman on DVD time?
Close.
Pervert time?
Nope. It's game time.
Game time.
Game time.
Gay time. Hey, bitch. Aristophanes time.
Oh,
Mark
Chris
found
time.
That music hilarious.
I think Sarah was saying something funny that we couldn't hear.
All right, everybody. This is the
third
game time of the season. Tara has 2 points. I just want to apologize to Trip Payne for last week's game time. I both screwed up the name of the game, which was supposed to be
If It's Funny Once,
not It's Funny Once. And also, I forgot to randomize the questions before we started playing, so I put Daily Show right before the Colbert Report question. He was mortified, and rightly so. So apologies to Trip Payne. We'll do better. Cool. Well, he's a game master by profession, so he, you know.
I believe Captain Quesada had some comments about this terrible lapse in your judgment, Dave Cole.
Me too.
God damn, Cole.
Let's hear them.
How many ways are there for me to say shut the fuck up?
Kind of harsh, but all right.
Let's find out how many ways.
Oh, for Christ's sake, fuck off, Cole.
There we go. I like that one best. Yeah.
All right. So today, game time comes from Ken B, who earns himself an extra credit. Redeemable for an extra hot, great mini topic of his choosing. Ken sent us a game we are calling The Bridges.
Oh.
Okay. This is how it works. I am going to give you the name of a performer and a bridge show. You must give me the name of the shows credited to that performer, both before and after the bridge show.
Okay. Do we have an example?
Yes.
Yay.
I think we do. But I don't know where it is. Let's
say. So if you were to say Aeschylus.
Let's say the.
He's not a performer. Nice try.
The actor is Julia.
Wasn't he?
Julia.
Louis-Dreyfus.
Yes. Uh-huh. The bridge show is New Adventures of Old Christine.
Okay.
You would name the show that happened before and the show that happened with her after.
Watching Ellie.
Watching Ellie and Veep.
Yes, that would be correct. Okay, so that's how you play. You get 1 point for the before show, 1 point for the after show. You must identify which is which. Okay. You can't just blindly guess. Tell me the before and the after.
Okay.
There are no hints. You don't have to go in order. You can give me the after first, give me the before, whatever you want.
Sure.
That's your prerogative.
Okay.
But you must correctly identify the before and after one. All right. Let's see who.
How many are there?
There are 30 questions. Everybody's got 10 to answer. All right. You got maximum 2 points per question that you can snag. So we'll see who goes first with our person in control choosing initiative, better known as everybody's favorite robot, Picky 3000. Come on, Picky.
Dick.
We will start with Tara.
All right. So we're going to go Tara, then Sarah, and then Mark. Are you ready to play the... Bridges.
Yes.
All right. Taras.
Yes.
Actor is Deborah Messing. The Bridge Show, Will and Grace.
Before Ned and Stacy. After Smash. What?
After The Starter Wife.
Oh, I even watched that piece of shit. All
right. So
Mark just mouthed that, so yeah.
1 point. Out of two for that. Okay. And we're on to Sarah. Your actor, Andre Brower.
Okay.
The Bridge Show, Last Resort.
Ooh. The Bridge Show's Last Resort.
Yes.
Okay.
Before Last Resort and after Last Resort.
Before is Men of a Certain Age. And after is Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Nice.
2 points for Sarah. Here's
Andre Brower, always on TV.
Mark, this is yes. Kismet. Rue McClanahan, Bridge Show, Golden Girls.
Okay, after is Golden Palace. And before... Okay, before she was on that fine series, The Golden Girls, she was on the...
Following
Mary
show.
Mary Tyler Moore Show? Shit.
Maude.
Mama's Family.
Oh, I was thinking Mama's Family.
I was thinking Oedipus and Colonus.
Oedipus and Colonic, I think was.
Yes.
Tara.
Yes.
Kate Jackson, The Bridge Show, no. Charlie's Angels.
Oh, God.
You might get one of these.
Okay, after Scarecrow and Mrs. King?
Is that your answer?
After is Scarecrow and Mrs. King. Before? Yeah. I don't know. I was not born.
I never heard of the show The Rookies.
Nope.
No.
What?
Yeah. Okay, they can't all be easy, guys. Sarah.
Mexico Bell Bottom Hour. Yes.
Walton, not Walter. Walton Goggins.
Yes.
Okay, the bridge show, Vanessa and Jan.
What? That was a show?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. So.
Okay, I'm just going to hope that the after show is justified.
Yes.
All right, now you've placed it
Vanessa
in time.
Vanessa and Jan. Everyone knows that before that, Walton Goggins was on. 0 Hour. Just kidding. No one was on 0 Hour.
Was it The Shield?
It was The Shield. Yes, it was.
Oh, Whoa. Sure.
All right, Mark.
Wall's going to kill me for not knowing.
Yes.
Dylan McDermott in the bridge show American Horror Story.
Ah, this one should have been for Sarah.
Okay, after is Hostages.
Weren't we all?
Is prior The Practice?
Nice.
Whoa!
Nicely done.
What?
I'm surprised he didn't do anything between The Practice and I guess he did movies.
These are main, like, there's no, like, guest spots and stuff like that.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, so back to Tara.
Yep.
Kyle Chandler, Bridge Show, Memory Lane, The Lion's Den.
Oh, with a Y.
Yes.
Okay, after show is Friday Night Lights. Before show is Early Edition.
Nice.
Wow.
Good pull.
Nice.
Sarah.
Yes.
This seems like it's in your wheelhouse. Howard Hesserman.
Hessman.
Hessman. No R.
Still no R in his name. Howard. Never was, never will be.
Oh, we'll see about that.
Oh, I've got files.
Whoops.
Oh, for Christ's sake, fuck off, Cole.
All right. Howard Hessman.
Yes. For Sarah.
For Sarah. The Bridge Show. Oh, no. We lost Sarah. The Bridge Show for Howard Hessman. Uh-huh. One day at a time.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I think the before show is WKRP in Cincinnati. And the after show is Head of the Class.
Nice.
Very nicely done.
Arvid.
Okay.
Now Mark is at the Head of the Class.
Mark.
That was great.
Yes.
John Ritter.
Uh-huh.
Bridge show. Oh, boy. Bridge show, Hearts of Fire.
Oh, God.
Oh, shit.
Okay, is the after show 8 Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter?
Nice.
Wow.
Oh, God.
And the before show?
He was in so many shows in the 90s.
I know. He was a detective, I think, in one.
Yes.
We'll call it Trapper.
Oh.
You're on the right track.
Was it Hooperman?
It was Hooperman.
It was like
yes.
I would have also guessed Hooperman.
Single cam sitcom, I think.
Oh, boy. All right. Score break, please.
Oh, this is a really tight one.
Okay.
Mark and I are tied with 4 points each.
Yep.
Sarah has 5.
Nice.
Whoa.
I hesitate to mention this, but Tara, I think you have 5, no?
No, she's got 4 by my reckoning as well.
Okay.
Okay, back to...
But your honesty speaks well of you.
Back to Tara.
Yep.
Eric McCormack.
Mm-hmm.
Bridge show, Trust Me.
Okay. After is Perception. And before is Will and Grace.
Wow.
Correct. Sarah?
Perception, by the way, if I may, is on a list of shows I've only watched because we got a screener of them. Continue.
All right.
A dim bulb, if you will.
Indeed.
Bradley mm-hmm. Whitford. Bridge show.
Yes.
Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
Nice.
Okay. Before show is The West Wing.
Oh, shit.
The after show. Tricky one, I think, maybe.
Yep, it is.
Although I shouldn't even be saying that. I'm a bad impartial.
Right. No, I mean, I
knew
it
wasn't. I was
going to
do it, too.
I knew it wasn't. Well, okay, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
So just in case it actually is Trophy Wife, after show is Trophy Wife.
The Good Guys?
The Good Guys is the right.
God,
a show with
right.
such promise that never executed.
Yeah, that was a bummer.
It really seemed
Who
like it
the
had.
The other good guy?
Colin Hanks.
Yeah. Back to Mark?
Yep.
The actor?
Yes.
Jane Curtin.
Mm-hmm.
Jane Curtin.
Mm-hmm.
The Bridge Show, Working It Out.
Oh, God.
Jesus.
Look, it's better to get the weird one.
I would just like to say that I don't
think
that show is real.
Hey, you may complain, but it's better to get the weird one as the bridge show than one of the answers.
You're right.
It does.
So I'll say that the after show is Third Rock from the Sun. And I'll say that the before show is Kate and Allie.
Nice.
See?
Yeah.
See?
Working it out.
Apology accepted.
Working it out does seem like the name of a fake show that, Mark, you made up as a star vehicle for, like, penetration.
And it has a theme music like this. They're working it out.
Tons of freeze frames of them.
Yeah.
And everybody's jumping in the air at the same time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then there's a scene where everyone playfully sprays spray cheese on each other. Oh, stop.
I just want to let everyone know, I know it's not time for an official score break. However, we are all three of us at this moment tied with 6 points.
Good gracious.
Oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit.
Six, six,
okay,
six.
Let's see how it goes from here.
Game of the Beast.
Tara.
Yes.
Matthew Fox.
Right.
The Bridge Show. Haunted.
Okay. Before Party of Five. After Lost. Thank you.
Correct. Sarah.
Yes.
Tony Shalhoub. The Bridge Show, the Stark Lube. Raving Mad.
Ah, yes.
We've lost Mark. Mark Raving Mad. Shit. Well, the before show is Wings.
Yes.
The after show is Monk.
Nice.
Correct. By the way, that was question 17.
Spread Eagle.
Yes.
Spread Eagle.
Mark.
Yes.
Laura Prepon. Excuse me.
Okay.
Do you have any Laura Prepon?
But of course.
Well, I guess I do.
The show. Are you there, Chelsea?
Yes, girl. Oh, wait. That wasn't a question. Okay. The after show is Orange is the New Black. The pre-show is That 70s Show.
Ooh. Correct.
And we're still tied!
And that was going to be my next thing. God. That was the score break. We're still tied. All right.
8-8-8.
Wow. All right. Here we go.
Year of the Beast. Okay.
Yes.
David Spade, yep. Just Shoot Me. Ooh. Is the Bridge Show.
Okay. After Rules of Engagement. Fuck, was it that Hollywood Minute show?
I'll tell you.
Okay. Before is Hollywood Minute. No. What was this Comedy Central show called? Hollywood Minute with David Spade.
That was a show?
It was he had a brief, like, roundup news show on. Obviously that's not right.
Shit. Eight Simple Rules.
On that show.
Was
the after.
Do I have to look this up?
No, okay. I believe you.
Before is listed as Saturday Night Live, but if you're saying that there's a
Well, I don't know if it can, I mean, whatever. I don't know what.
But if he's not playing a fictional character,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
he wouldn't have been in on IMDb because it would have been as himself.
Yeah.
Although I guess that was true of SNL's too. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. I accept.
All right.
David Spade ruins everything
again.
It's official.
Sarah.
Yep.
Ted Danson.
Yep.
Bridge Show. Bored to Death.
The Bridge Show is Bored to Death. Oh, damn it. Okay, the after show is CSI Original Flav. And the before show is, oh my god, why can't I think of the name of it? I know I want to say Evening Shade, which is wrong, because that's Burt Reynolds, totally different.
But I can't tell you're on the right track, because I can follow your synapses.
They were probably time slot neighbors at some point.
Yeah. Oh my god, why can't I think of the name of it? Oh! It starts with a B, right?
That information I cannot give you.
No, I mean, it wouldn't help me. I know it starts with a B.
Oh, my God.
Becker! Yeah! Becker! It's Becker!
But wasn't he on Damages?
He's a regular cast member.
Right, he was a guest star because it was
different. Oh, okay, okay.
I am so proud of myself.
That was amazing.
As you should be.
Holy shit. I was like, I know it is six letters. It starts with B. Help me! Becker!
Mark Tholomew. Kyle MacLachlan.
Okay.
The Bridge Show. Injustice. In space. Justice.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure. God.
Was Annie Potts on that? Probably.
Only if it were in INN, Justice, and they have a B&B.
About a hotel detective?
Lawyers only. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my. I would watch the shit out of that show.
I would write that show.
Okay. Injustice. was the prior show Twin Peaks? Well, was the after show Sex and the City?
Before show was Sex and the City. After show, shit. Desperate Housewives.
Well, yeah. Sorry, Kyle.
Yeah. All right, Tara.
Fuck off, Kyle.
Cloris Leachman. Mm-hmm. The bridge show, Phyllis.
Okay. The before show was the Mary Tyler Moore show.
Mary Tyler Moore show?
Was it? Okay. What a show was she on after that as a series regular? I don't know, so I'm just going to say Raising Hope.
The Facts of Life?
Oh, of course.
Oh, as life. Aunt Beverly.
I watched
all right.
it.
Yeah.
Okay. You take the good, you take the bad.
You uh-huh. really do.
I need closure.
That's it. Oh. You take them both.
Take them both, Dave.
There you have.
Fuck yes. off, Cole.
Yes. What?
The Facts of Life.
Okay, all right. Sarah. Yes. Mark Harmon. Bridge uh-huh. Show, Chicago Hope.
The Bridge Show, Chicago Hope? Oh, God. Okay. So the after show is NCIS, famous original. And the before show, this can't be right, but I think he was off doing movies, so let me just guess it was Saint Elsewhere.
Yay!
Oh! Whoa!
Nice!
Wow. Rocking and rolling.
Mark.
What number are we on?
Courtney Thorne Smith. This
Mark
is your
Stasswood.
This is
sorry.
Your second. This is your penultimate question.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh,
thank
penultimate.
You.
Penultimate. I see.
It's, dramaturgically
I that
speaking,
word was coined by
it
Molière.
Is your penultimate question.
Okay.
Courtney Thorne Smith, Bridge Show, mm-hmm. Ally McBeal.
Okay, I think the prior show was Melrose Place. All right,
yeah, buddy.
And oh shit! After Ally McBeal, was she was on a maybe it was one of those shows about like models. Sarah's like, I can't help you with this. I'm gonna say New York Dolls.
She thinks she's one of the models, but it was not one of those shows. It was,
according to goddamn Jim.
That is correct.
Oh, gross!
My nemesis,
dim bulb indeed.
Tarariano, your Jingle. Second to last question.
Yes, sir.
Christina Applegate.
Yep.
Bridge show, Jesse.
Okay. Before was Married with Children. Okay. And after was Samantha who? Hey.
Ooh, nice.
All right. Sarah.
Yep.
Lucille Ball.
Oh, Christ.
Bridge show.
Ernie Kovacs. Just kidding.
Bridge show. The Lucy show.
The Philco Playhouse Hour.
The bridge show is the Lucy show.
That's great.
Okay. Before show is I Love Lucy. After show is Living with Lucy.
Oh, you were right that every show she's ever done has Lucy in the title. The name of that one was Here's Lucy.
And then I think after that there was Life with Lucy. Yes.
Probably.
Yeah.
Then Lucy
there
was, Goosey.
Then there was Lucy Goosey. Then there was Lucy, Daughter of the Devil.
Lucy the Hogan family.
Yeah. Bride of Lucy.
All right. Mark.
Yes.
This is your second to last question.
He was wrong.
Oh.
Before.
Matthew Perry. Studio 60 okay. on the Sunset Strip is the bridge show.
Okay, I think the after show is Mr. Sunshine.
Nice.
Thank Christ.
Nice.
And the prior show is Friends?
Correct.
Yay! All right.
So.
This is really exciting. Still, Mark and I are tied with 11 points each. Sarah has 13.
Oh!
Done!
All right. So, Tara, the best yes. you can do here is get both points and hope Sarah does not get any points.
Why would I hope that?
Well, if you want to win, which you do, and I know
it's
you
more
do,
like a statistical
because you never want
but...
not want to win.
Listen,
your actor is
yes.
Peter Krause.
Uh huh.
What?
Go ahead. Did That's I right. Not say that? No, okay. you're right.
All right.
Yay,
Peter Krauserman.
Hey, why are you snickering at back there?
I'm not. It's no, a funny name.
Howard Hetzerman.
I'm,
and
that
Peter
snickering
Krause
question was for Sarah. I heard it.
Dick.
All right, here we go. Peter Krause.
Yes.
Battle Hill.
Bridge show. Dirty Sexy Money.
Okay, before is 6 Feet Under. After is Parenthood.
2 points. Okay, that puts you in the tie with Sarah.
Correct.
Sarah.
Yes.
Come on.
All right. Your actor is Heather Locklear. Your bridge show, Melrose Place.
Ooh.
My bridge show is Melrose Place.
Yes. Okay, before
you guys have never.
Now keep in mind, you only have to get one of these to win.
Right.
Let me just talk to you about the degree of emotions that just went across Sarah's face.
All of them rage. It's like a lightning storm on the sun. Okay. The bridge show is Melrose Place.
Yes.
Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay.
The actress
after
is.
After show.
Heather Locklear.
She says after.
Yes.
After show.
The after show is Spin City.
And the before show?
Can you just ring the bell? Dick.
Spin City's correct. You.
Spin City's correct.
Yeah!
And the before show?
Before show, I'm actually not sure, and I think this is probably wrong, but I can't remember what nighttime soap she was on, so I'm just going to say TJ Hooker.
Oh, yeah. I think that's...
Yeah. She was on that for sure. Oh, no, that was Heather Thomas.
Yes. That's right.
No, she was on there.
That. Locklear was on Hooker. I think she just was on whatever, the Colbys before.
Or like Dallas or...
Was she on
Falcon
Crest
Dynasty?
Dynasty is what is listed.
Yeah, yes, Dynasty.
Well, here's what happened. I actually don't know why I know this, but I do. She left Dynasty to do TJ Hooker, and then after that was canceled, she went back to Dynasty for the last 2 seasons.
Okay. Mark, with the knowledge bomb.
I'm sorry you didn't get that question.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Sarah won.
All right, Mark, your last question.
Yes.
Judd Hirsch, The Bridge Show, George and Leo.
Oh, God.
Judd Hirsch?
Yeah, Judd Hirsch.
Breakfast Club fame?
That's Judd Nelson.
Oh, Judd Hirsch of Ordinary People fame. Okay.
Really different movie.
George Leo. Is he currently on that show, Dads?
No.
Oh.
He is currently on a show, but I won't say for an answer
about a sitcom.
Okay, you know what I'm going to say? I don't know. The prior show is Dear John.
Yep.
Oh, hey, great. By the
Sarah
time
knows what
you
the after
read
show
these lines,
yes, she does.
I'll be gone.
She's not proud of it.
And Magnuson as well.
You got an after show answer there, Mark?
After Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. He had a guest spot on that one. I know it's wrong.
Num-threers.
He is currently on Marin. He plays Mark Maron's dad on Marin.
Oh, and for shits and giggles, this was our tiebreaker. Candy Alexander, Bridge Show, CSI Miami. Before?
The Corner? News Radio.
News Radio is
The
before.
Corner was a miniseries.
And after?
Treme,
correct. Well, very well done.
That was a fun one.
Yeah, that was good. Sorry about the...
I agree.
Lion's Den...
It's all right.
West Wing stuff. That happens. So
everyone got a peek behind the curtain.
Yeah. Congratulations, Sarah D. Bunting.
Woo!
All of us high school.
Sarah.
All right, that's it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We discuss whether or not we'd be looking for more of HBO's Looking before we took on a new case investigating the crime drama True Detective. And Sarah explained why she is not a crackpot for suggesting My Sweet Audrina to complete the Andrews trifecta. Nick pitched us the unexpected twist, a pivotal episode from The Amazing Race's first season for the canon, and I'm sorry to say it was eliminated from the canon race. We went around the dial, crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time from Ken. Thanks to both Ken and Nick for their contributions this week. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole on behalf of Tara Ariano.
Can't talk, hallucinating.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Dramaturgically speaking.
And Mark Blankenship.
Give me a tall boy. I mean an actual tall boy.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
God damn, Cole. How many ways are there for me to say, shut the fuck up?